Welcome to Backyard Oasis, a podcast designed by and for older adults living in the beautiful Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts and produced in the tech studios at Greenfield Community College in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Backyard Oasis reaches out to older adults who seek knowledge to help them live more thoughtfully, healthily, and happily, who hope to inspire others with their ideas, and who serve their communities in the interest of the greater good. We hope you join us frequently in our pleasant backyard oasis for wide-ranging conversations with a diversity of people who are growing older and want to talk about it. Hi, this is Dennis Lee. I'm calling this episode of Backyard Oasis, I Really Want to Make a Local Movie. Our guest today did. Stan Freeman wrote, produced, and shot an independent film called The Pitch. And he's got with him the lead actor, John Haig, who is a professional actor. So we've got lots to talk about. This movie is amazing how it all came about. I think you can make a movie on how the movie was made. It's really that interesting. Stan, welcome to you and John. Great to see you. First of all, what is The Pitch about?
It's a story about two sports writers who are looking into the life of a former ball player who threw only one pitch in the major leagues, so for the Yankees back 50 years ago in the 1970s. And John plays the older sports writer. There's a younger sports writer who really wants to do this project. He wants to find out why this guy's life ended up so badly. After he threw the pitch, he was out of baseball within a month, and he was homeless, became an alcoholic, and eventually died in terrible straits. And this young reporter approaches John, who is a retired sports writer who actually grew up with the player, and wants to know why this guy's life turned out so bad. And the story is kind of a mystery because there is a secret at this, and John is trying to protect it.
Interesting. So I can't really say it's a baseball movie, but
right.
It starts with the guy failing in baseball, but the story is much bigger than that.
It's a character-driven story against the backdrop of baseball. So if you're not a baseball fan, this should interest you anyway.
So how did this movie happen? I mean, not everybody wakes up one day and decides to make a movie. I know that originally you wrote it as a play. You did a reading. I know you did that.
Right.
And then it turned into a play that they performed in West Springfield.
Right.
You were going to bring it on the road for yourself. That was all during COVID. It was a mess.
Right.
And you said, I want to make a movie. So that's amazing. But the thing that I find interesting, how does somebody come up with the idea? Did you wake up one morning and you had these characters bouncing around your cerebrum? How did it work?
The short explanation is I was a career reporter at the paper in Springfield. I was the science and environmental writer. And after deadline one night, I was reading that day's paper, and there was an obituary in the paper about a guy who had worked, who had played minor league ball for a couple of years and then come back to West Springfield, where he was born, never really did much in the minor leagues, and worked in the local mills for the rest of his life. I thought that would make an interesting short story.
Hmm.
So I wrote a story. It went in a drawer. And about 10 years later, when the newspaper was kind of falling apart, I took it out and I was trying to think of ways to make it off the paper. And I turned this into a play that originally a producer in New York optioned. But nothing ever came of the play in New York. I put it back in a drawer. 7 or 8 years later, a friend read it. He knew John. He showed John the play. John really liked it. He said, we should do a public reading. It's never been, done a public reading of this. And we did a public reading. At the same time, John said, you should send this to Danny Eaton, who's the producing director of the Majestic Theater, which is really the last...
In West Springfield,
West Springfield,
yeah.
The last, professional theater in our area. The reading went great, and Danny loved the play, and so we ended up doing it at the Majestic for a 5-week run. that was split up by COVID by about 17 months. And after that was over, when we got very good reviews, and we initially planned to take it on the road, but for various reasons, we didn't. And then I started thinking about, well, we could actually make this into a feature film ourselves, which is what we did.
I was going to ask the question, how did you know it was any good when you wrote it? But you partially answered that. You had somebody read it, because, you know, we all have ideas.
Right.
But did you run it by people, and they decided that in their mind it was good, so that's what gave you a good feeling about actually doing it?
If you've been writing for any length of time, you depend on both those things, your own instinct about the work you do and also people who read it. Because a lot of times you think something's good and they read it, they're just not interested, and the other way it happens also. But in this case, it was at public reading at the Forbes Library in Northampton. We just expected 15 or 20 people. About 50 people showed up. It was just, they loved the play. And then Danny, at the Majestic, offering us a run on stage there for an unproduced play by an unknown playwright, that, you know, was enough. And then I saw it performed 40 times at the Majestic. And the audience, they loved that play. So that gave me confidence to make this into a movie.
I can't even imagine how somebody, now you never really were involved, you didn't go to film school, you were a science writer.
Right.
So how does somebody that literally knows nothing about making a movie,
right,
you wake up one day and you talk to your friends and you say, I want to make a movie. Well, there's a lot of things I'd like to do, but I don't know anything about.
COVID. So, COVID is the answer.
COVID.
During COVID, I'm stuck at home with nothing to do, and so I made four short films, one of which John was in, with just one or two actors at a time. We'd all take our little COVID test, and then he'd come over. And I got good at these short films. And so then it was at that point we began thinking about the feature film, and it's not a big jump up from short films to a feature film.
So what was the process, though? In other words, you decided, I want to make a movie.
Right.
But I've never made a movie. So where did you go? Did you go to the library? Did you go to the old Google machine? How did you find out how the heck you make a movie?
Well, one little backstory is I did make a movie previously. I didn't direct it, but I wrote it and produced it, and it was called The God Question, and it got very mixed reviews, and I learned a big lesson from that, what not to do when you choose a project.
What was the lesson?
The lesson is, don't make a movie about an idea. Make a movie about a human drama. And the pitch was about that, and it got a really good reaction all along the way.
Hmm. Yeah, it is a really interesting idea, and I can't believe you could actually learn all this stuff.
Google is partially, it was COVID and Google.
Well, I mean, we're talking about making a movie. We're talking about learning how to make sets. We're learning about casting, which is a huge thing, getting the right people.
Right.
And the all-important editing. And I know from talking with John off the air that he says in your movie he loved the editing, because most people that go to a movie, I don't think they think about editing.
Right.
I mean, they watch the movie, they like it or they don't. But it's, in other words, editing is how you put it all together.
I'll say a quick thing. Everything in the arts comes down to your personal judgment of what works and what doesn't. Whether it's editing, acting, writing, it's all that one little skill. Can you follow your instincts about how to do this? And that's the secret to all of this.
Wow. Yeah. And, of course, John, you have an interesting career. You're a professional actor. I know you've taught acting. He's also a really good guy, but that's a whole other thing. And the thing is, I want to tell you, he laughs at my jokes. So that's really the reason I like him, because if I run into him and I tell him my worst jokes, he laughs. He could get he could actually make money at a club laughing, because he's got a great laugh. But that has nothing to do with your movie. But let's talk
maybe
about.
Maybe I have another career.
You might have another career. So tell us about your background. What's your background in acting?
I started out doing plays. I didn't know what I wanted to do back then, except stay out of Vietnam. So I figured I'd just teach, and I got bored with teaching after a while. I was teaching, theater and and English, actually, in a high school on Long Island. And there was a theater there by the name of I'm flaking on the name of it now. The
Theater A, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. It's a theater in Suffolk County that was very popular back then. Anyway, they were doing, and I had no acting experience. I'd thought of it very, very briefly. But they were doing a production of Macbeth. And I figured, what do I have to lose? So I auditioned for this and got the part of Macduff. And my father had just died about 3 months before. And I was still grieving. And I poured all of that, you know, grief and rage into basically getting prepared for that last scene where he kills Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
And I stole the show. I got rave reviews. And I had no idea what I was doing. But I apparently had some emotional connection, mm-hmm. which is the mm-hmm. thing that you really need.
Right.
And so I just went to New York and started studying. And I got a lot of work off Broadway. I probably did about 40 plays off Broadway. And that was my education, along with a couple of great acting teachers.
Right. I know that we should mention that you had one of your kids when you were teaching that's now a star.
Oh, I don't know if I want to put that on tape. You know, I mean, I respect the man's privacy, but yeah, he's... you've heard of Hamilton, I assume.
I've heard of, yes, we've heard of Hamilton.
Well, it was a school for the gifted. That was a public school.
The guy is who? The actor is?
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Well, people know him, yeah.
And then there's Chris Hayes, a guy at MSNBC. He was another one. Yeah. He came up to me on the first day and said, "Excuse me, Mr. Haig, but can I be your teaching assistant?"
Yeah.
And he still speaks the same way. But he was 13 then and already ready for prime time.
And I know you did, I just found this out last week, you did a few soap operas.
I did do a couple of soap operas, which no longer exist. Ryan's Hope, you may have heard of. I had small parts there. That was kind of in the beginning of my career. I also had several roles in... a very early soap called Somerset, which no longer exists. But another very prominent actor was in that, too.
Right.
Met him. Very nice guy, too.
I want to talk a little bit. Go ahead, Stan. You were gonna...
No, I was going to ask, who was the actor?
Ted Danson.
Oh.
Ted Danson. Yeah. He's doing...
I'm probably going to get sued by all three of them.
By the way, Ted Danson is doing podcasts. I just...
Is that right?
One
A lot of people
last night.
Are.
I don't know if he's a nice guy or not. I've always thought he's pretty neat.
Well, he was a nice guy. I remember he was, chatting us all up. Well, oftentimes you work with celebrities.
Right.
You know, like I was in stand-in for a celebrity actor whose name I won't mention, and he didn't talk to anybody. Except the director, you know. So you kind of felt like you were sort of dispensable.
Yeah. Well, I think it's always nice to meet people that you have an image of, mm-hmm. and when you meet them, they're nice. That doesn't
Absolutely.
Always work out.
No.
They're nice people, and they're terrible people, and most of us are somewhere in between, depending on what the day is. So, but it's nice when you meet somebody and then, they were nice, and you learn something from them. I want to talk a little bit about the difference between being on TV and being on stage and being in the movies. What's the difference in that kind of acting?
The space, you're dealing, like we're talking right here very in a very civil tone, not raising the volume very much because we have microphones a couple of inches from our face. Whereas the stage requires magnification, and that goes for everything, not just the voice, the body, everything. Because if you don't magnify, and project, as they say, the audience is not really part of it, So they shouldn't ever make an audience work for anything, mm-hmm. They don't need to work for anything. We do the work, and you can feel when they're actually connected. And the one thing I'd like to say about the pitch is right from the start, you felt the audience on every with you, every word.
This was in the play.
That was actually in the play, yeah.
Yeah.
So with film, you have to essentially do the opposite. That's all about the inner work, much more so than a staged play. So if you feel grief, and I mean not play grief or pretend to have feeling of grief, and I think that first play that I did bore this out, the audience will get it. But it needs to really happen from within with film. Otherwise, you see the artifice. And you don't ever want the audience to see the technique. That has to disappear. And once I learned that, I was on my way.
It must be an interesting thing, though, when you are not used to seeing yourself on screen. We all have habits, the way we flinch, the way our eyebrows go up or go down, or with our hands, if we speak with our hands.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that necessarily until you see yourself. Yeah. That's got to be, at first, I bet, kind of shocking.
It was humbling, you know, but you have to do it. Because if you don't do it, you don't know what you're doing. So you have to do it.
Right.
And I never liked watching myself.
Right,
a lot of actors don't, but I have to.
I know some people that won't watch. I know people, I've read stories where people will not watch themselves. They don't want to know anything about it.
The very first scene we did in the film, I was never happy with it. And to this man's credit... He said, if there's something you're not happy with, he trusted us. And if there's something you're not happy with, by all means, we'll repeat it. And he structured the whole thing in such a way that that was possible, as opposed to what Hollywood does.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit, Stan, about the process, because I think the story about the pitch in this whole thing is so interesting to take something from nothing, an idea. We go to a reading, a play, and now Stan says, I think I want to make a movie. I mean, I think that's an amazing thing to have happen. Particularly, that's not what you've done for your living, and that's not your basic knowledge. Right. So I think it's wonderful. So tell us a little bit about actually shooting the pitch. First of all, how long did it take to do that?
We shot this very unconventionally. We shot it over 7 months. And we shot, on average... One or two scenes a week, and we never worked more than 2 hours at a time. And that was a lesson I learned from that film I did about 10 years ago, The God Question. The crew came in, the director came in, we worked, 12, 13, 14-hour days, and it just is awful, an awful thing. But people do it in Hollywood because they want to get the film done. But one of the lessons I learned is try to do this in a way that's more humane. So we shot this very slowly, and I had a lot of time each week to edit what we had done the previous week, so I knew what else had to be done, and it was more a hobby. Now, one thing to say is I'm 76, and John is up in age, too. He's about the same bracket. So for both of us, we're not looking for hard work now. We're looking for things that are fun to do. And you shoot a film this way, it was fun.
So how many cameras did you use? Technically,
I also learned during COVID, because I couldn't, use a crew or anything like that, I learned to shoot with multiple cameras. And I have a bunch of cameras, but the best camera I have is my cell phone. And it shoots 8K video, if you're familiar with that. Everybody knows what 4K is now. 8K video gives you manual control of focus, ISO, and shutter speed. And it just works terrifically. So I went on eBay, bought two more copies of this same camera. It was a Samsung S22. And bought the necessary tripod and attachment to shoot with a cell phone. And that's how I shot this. Three cell phones on tripods at different angles. And that gave me the ability to cut very quickly back and forth in the midst of a scene of these three cameras. So you could see John, and you could see our other star, Julian Finley, or you can see a two-shot of both of them. And there was no continuity problems. I'll explain that. A lot of times you will watch a Hollywood movie where they shoot one angle at a time, and you'll see a character with his arms folded. They show the other angle, and he's got his hands down at his side. That's called the continuity error. But you shoot with multiple cameras, you never have continuity problems because you're getting three angles of the same scene, the same behavior, and it makes the scene go faster because we didn't have to break down and then reset up at a different angle, and it makes editing tremendously easier because of that.
Now, what did it cost you to make the movie when you put it all together?
Right.
Roughly.
$19,000.
$19,000.
The average price of a Hollywood film is $50 million, $50 to $100
million. That's amazing.
Right.
That is amazing. Well, you had to get all these people, though, with a cast. So tell us about... Now, John is a professional actor.
Right.
Julian, I guess, is a professional actor, too.
Right.
But then you used all kinds of people that all of a sudden... So you want to be in a movie? Oh, yeah. Show up at the library. We're going to shoot a scene.
We got a local guy named Dennis Lee to do the announcing, the baseball announcing, at the beginning of the film. He did a terrific job.
It was only about 60 seconds. I can't take any credit.
Whatever.
And that's not, by the way, I didn't want people to think that's why we're doing the podcast. I'm fascinated by the whole thing.
The reason we're doing this is because you ran out of guests. You needed guests.
Yeah. No, that was fun because I grew up as a Yankee fan. Now, John is a long-suffering Met fan.
Please don't mention that.
I grew up going to Yankee Stadium, and when they used a little bit of what I did, which was about 60 seconds,
right.
I was doing play-by-play. I was a frustrated play-by-play announcer. I grew up listening to Mel Allen of How About That fame.
Right.
And here I was play-acting that. So that was wonderful. It started, by the way, folks, just to show you how this whole thing came together. This originally started when Stan was going to do the reading at a library, and we recorded my little part at his kitchen table on his cell phone or something.
Right.
And we did that, and then I didn't think anything of it. I didn't think this
was
going to be anything.
It was still used at every stage in this. At the Majestic it was used.
Yeah,
and
I wasn't
good job.
Even thinking about being involved. You know, all of a sudden, now it's in the movie. I'm going, wow, kind of neat. But, you know, I just did it for you because you're a good guy and it was fun. You know, that was the deal. So, but you had all these other people. And you had I remember there's one guy who played a priest because you had a card scene. And he was, you had him dressed up as a priest and he got a big deal out of playing the priest. Tell us about some of the people.
Okay, so the major actors in this, John Haig, who lives about a mile from me in Florence, Julian Finley, who lives up in Franklin County, and Reynolds Whalen lives in Greenfield. Cliff Miller was the only actor we brought in from outside because he bore some resemblance to John when John was younger, and he plays a younger version of John in this very briefly. But other actors there are a lot of actors in the Valley. They do regional theater, they do film, they go back and forth to Boston and New York if they can. So it wasn't hard to find actors, but a lot of the smaller roles were people I knew, friends. You know, they were extras or they might have had one line or two or something like that. And everybody had a good time doing it. And it's not hard to find actors when you're doing something like this.
I never would have thought about that. You know, I never thought about casting a movie. That's not something I've ever even thought about.
Yeah, you know what was remarkable from my point of view was how smoothly it went. I'd never been in anything, you know, like a film. I've been in a lot of them. But never did you ever see anything go without a hitch. And these were, you know, movies that I did in New York, a lot of it background stuff. But you got to learn a lot from observing how there were constant breakdowns and disagreements and occasionally worse. And this went all 7 months, correct me if I'm wrong, without a hitch. His preparation, I mean, some of these Hollywood guys could maybe learn from this guy when it comes to preparation. He came prepared. And
As did the actors, by the way.
And I think we did.
Yes, you did. Yeah.
Because I knew right away. I've read a lot of scripts in my life. I've taught theater in New York for about 10 years at Hunter College High School. And I know a good script at this point, finally, when I see one. And I picked that up, and I was immediately, you know, like spritzing with excitement because the guy I played... I won't reveal anything too personal, but I understood him intuitively.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the toughest part about actually making the movie? When you look back from your standpoint,
right,
as somebody bringing everybody together, what was the most difficult part about doing this whole project?
You know, the odd thing is when you start out, you said there's going to be terrific problems and you just got to solve them one after another. But this went along, as John said, very smoothly without any real problems. And when it was over, it seemed almost a miracle that it went that smoothly. So I can't think of any. Oh, we had, yes, we had a scene at the, we had a scene in the city room at the Springfield newspapers, five scenes. And our actress who was going to be, had a major role in that. Everybody else reported to the Springfield newspaper on a Sunday morning, and we suddenly got an email from her that she was in the emergency room at Cooley Dickinson with a with a ruptured appendix.
Oh, okay.
And so we all had to go home, and I had to find a new actress, who I did within a week, a good actress, and we came back a couple of weeks later and did it. But that was the biggest mess up in the whole
thing.
How
did you find the new, when that happened? What
right.
was your process for finding somebody else?
Well, there's a site in New York called Backstage, and actors who want to act anywhere in the country, really, they put up demo reels. They establish a page. They put up demo reels. They put you find out what their resume is. Their resume is there. They pictures and so forth. And anyone who's making a film or, you know, trying to cast a play goes to Backstage. They put in the things they're looking for. They're looking for, you know, someone 30 to 35 who has some athletic school or whatever it is. And you can also look for people in a certain location. So I would always look for people who live in Western Massachusetts. And it was relatively simple.
That's amazing.
It's amazing how many people will immediately send resumes.
Right. So how many total people in the cast, roughly? Round it off.
Hold
if you're
on.
Wrong, who's gonna know?
I would guess about 40.
About 40 people.
Including extras, people who just were background, but really six or seven principal actors.
Now, I'm curious, as you now have the movie made,
right?
When you look back and you look at it, do you second guess yourself and say, oh, I wish I did this or I did that? Or are you comfortable with it? How do you feel when you? Because I know some actors don't
right.
like to look at themselves and they second guess what they did. How about as a director and writer?
I would say it's a real good, and I learned this from 30 years in newspapers, is when you finish something, you do your best you can when you're making it, and the next day you move on. You don't really, you can't, unless there's a lesson to be learned. Like if you're writing a newspaper article and you make a stupid misspelling or something, and you say, I can't do that again. You learn whatever lesson is obvious to learn, but otherwise you just do the best you can and move on.
Now, I'm going to relate that to baseball because the movie is called The Pitch. If you're a relief pitcher, you got to forget that you gave up a home run in the ninth inning.
Right.
You move on because you'd be paralyzed
right.
if you didn't move on, right?
Right.
Yeah.
He also gave us the permission to ask for redo. If you know, he didn't say, oh, well, no, I'm sorry. He wasn't rigid with us.
Right.
And I think that was especially for the two of us, for, you know, Julian and me.
Something else I learned is leave good actors alone. John and Julian were good actors, and they had established this rapport on stage for 40 performances, and I tried to leave them alone as much as possible.
That was a major benefit, right. The fact that we had done it on stage for however many performances. Yeah.
So we've talked about this whole movie. Now I think it's really important to tell people where they can see The Pitch.
Well, we got picked up by a distributor. It's on Amazon Prime. It is a $1.99 rental, but that won't break most people. And it's also available on four or five other streaming platforms. But you can go, if you've got Comcast, you go to your remote, you know, you use voice and you say The Pitch, 2024 film, and it'll come up somewhere. And if you watch it on Amazon, if you like it, please leave a review on Amazon.
And that does what?
That helps other people who are making a decision about whether to watch it. If they see, you know, a genuine review of it by someone who saw it, it helps them in making their decision.
Right. And thus far, we've gotten, we haven't been any, you know, like 5 out of 5s in terms
right.
of the rating.
How
yeah.
long has it been up, available to the public?
Probably about 3 weeks.
Right. and you figure this is going to be up there for a long time, and you're hoping
Be up there for, 10 years, so, yeah.
Right. That's amazing. Well, I'm sitting here wondering, as we sit here at GCC Studios in Greenfield, Massachusetts, do you have another movie in your noggin somewhere? Do you anticipate you're going to wake up tomorrow? John says, please do another movie. It was wonderful.
Because this was so easy to do, and really it gave me something to do every day for 2 or 3 hours a day. And when you're retired, that's what you want, something to do that's interesting. I do have another project that I'm starting in on, and we'll see
any
what
hints?
Happens. This one's science fiction.
Well, look, I think it's a wonderful story. That's why I wanted to do the podcast, because I can't imagine from nothing you really have something. And it's obviously something to be proud of, and it's amazing to watch the whole thing come together. And I wish you a lot of luck. So I want to thank Stan Freeman and John Haig for being with us today. This is Dennis Lee saying thank you for joining us for Backyard Oasis. This concludes today's podcast. We're always looking for new ideas, so feel free to reach out to Judy Raper, Associate Dean of Community Engagement at Greenfield Community College at 413-775-1819 if you have an idea you'd love to share. Special thanks to the creators of Backyard Oasis, Denise Schwartz, Chad Fuller, Dennis Lee, and Christine Copeland. Have a great day.